This is Business Law Talks, the Bennett Jones podcast series that sits at the intersection of law and policy. Join our lawyers and advisors as they examine today's most complex issues to help guide companies doing business in Canada.
We have a very distinguished panel today from our public policy group. In alphabetical order, the Honourable John Baird. John Baird has spent three terms as a Member of Parliament, 4 years as Foreign Minister, served as President of the Treasury Board, Minister of Environment, Transport, Infrastructure, and Leader of the Government and House. Prior to that, he served as a Senior Minister in the Ontario Government. John joins us from our Toronto office. Christy Clark was the Premier of British Columbia for 6 years. Christy, after inheriting a deficit, Christy left politics with a surplus, something I don't think we're going to see for a while anywhere else. She is based in our Vancouver office. The Honourable John Manley served in the federal government as Canada's Deputy Prime Minister, Finance Minister, Industry Minister. Prior to post-politics, he was the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Business Council of Canada, then known as the Canadian Council of Chief Executives. He's the chair of the board of CIBC and CAE and is on, like all of our panelists, on a number of corporate boards. He joins us from our Ottawa office. The Honourable Anne McClellan served as Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, Minister of Public Safety, Emergency Preparedness, Minister of Health, Attorney General of Canada. The Honourable Anne McClellan joins us from our Edmonton office. A few program notes. Our bipartisan webinar committee has agreed that each panelist will have 2 minutes for opening remarks, uninterrupted. Anyone interrupting will be muted. I promised not to do a Chris Wallace. As long as no one attacks the moderator, if they do, it is game on. We will again go back to alphabetical order. Mr. Baird. You're muted, Mr. Baird.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Hugh. I'll start off things by saying it does appear that we're looking at a President Biden. He only really needs to win Arizona and then Nevada to put him at exactly 270 seats. I think there is some funny business and shenanigans going on in a few cities, Atlanta and Philadelphia, but it increasingly does look like a Biden presidency. This is going to be a challenge for Ken in some respects. Obviously, he campaigned against the Keystone XL pipeline, and I would fear that he would issue a presidential order revoking his presidential permit upon taking office. He'll also want to do a number of things which will be deeply affected by something going on in Georgia. Senator David Perdue fell below a 50% threshold overnight, which means that very likely Georgia will face two runoff elections. And John Ossoff, the Democrat in Georgia, got 47.8%, and it was a very, very strong showing. And there's a very real possibility that he could defeat Senator Perdue, who got 49.8%. And that would mean that the Democrats could go up to 50 seats. And then with the vote of the vice president, things like court packing, adding new states, and then implementing his proposal to revoke all of the Trump tax cuts. So this will have a huge effect on Canada going forward. Those are just some opening thoughts, and I look forward to questions in the discussion.
Thank you very much. Christy Clark. I believe you're muted.
I guess what I would add to that, assuming that Joe Biden becomes the president, which I think we all are, and not knowing whether or not he'll get a Supreme Court majority, which I'm assuming he is less likely than likely. And remember, I mean, we all say, gee, there's going to be lots of money spent on that, winning that Senate election. The Democrats raised historic amounts of money, and Trump almost won the election. So, you know, if the president had been a little bit better a lot better in the first debate and perhaps restrained himself a little bit throughout the campaign, he might have won the whole shooting match, but he didn't. Joe Biden, despite the massive amounts of money the Democrats spent, did not get the result that they should have or that they'd been hoping to get, including controlling the Senate. So I think, you know, if we assume for a second that the Republicans are going to continue to control the Senate, what Mitch McConnell has said is he's going to encourage, or I guess force, Joe Biden to appoint more moderate members to his cabinet, which I think will be a great thing. I think it'd be great for the Democrats because, they're clearly to the left of the American public in terms of opinion at the moment. And I think it'll be better for Canada to have people who can think more holistically about trade, about the importance of oil and gas, the importance of the strength of the relationship between our two countries. I do think, though, that with Joe Biden as president, one thing that it's kind of an ephemeral thing, but I think it's fundamentally important for our relationship is Canada will start to see itself move itself a little bit farther away from this sort of antagonist to America, back to our traditional role of being best friend to America, which I do think that Biden's going to engage much more positively on an international level. And I do think that Canada being seen again across this longest undefended border in the world as a friend of America rather than as an enemy, I think will be a really important change overall for the trade relationship. Hard to define, but I think that's going to make a difference for us.
Thank you. John Manley.
Thanks, Hugh. I saw a poll recently of Canadians that said 75% were hopeful that Biden would be elected president of the United States. And had I been polled, I guess I would have given that answer. And I say that not out of any ideological or partisan point of view, but because for the Western world, the last 4 years has been exceedingly disruptive. We've had a president who has made a practice of essentially disavowing, attacking, disrupting the architecture of the international world, that much of which was constructed over the last 70 years by the United States itself. And I think for most Western governments, whether they're right of center or left of center, they're going to welcome the possibility that perhaps we return to some degree of normalcy, that we aren't going to have to follow Twitter to know what the policy of the United States is, that we can actually engage with serious counterparts to know what they're thinking. But what underlies this, I think, is also deeply worrying, because I think what we've seen demonstrated in the election is a deep division in American society, one in which, and I don't even actually, I might disagree with Christy a little bit here. I don't actually think it's a left-right split. I think it's more of an urban-rural split. It's a split between intellectual and cultural elites, many of whom live on the coasts, in which chances are most of us on this call would be included, and rural and lower middle class Americans, who, as Tom Friedman in the New York Times the other day said, the only middle finger they could find to give to the system was embodied by Donald Trump. Not about his politics, his policies, or his ideology, just a moment of saying, we reject all of this, and this man speaks for us. I don't know how America puts itself back together from that divide. I think we all need to hope that Joe Biden is a very successful mediator of that divide, because in fact, I believe the world needs a strong United States of America and one that's able, willing, and capable of leading. Thanks, Hugh.
Thanks, John. Anne McClellan.
Thank you very much, Hugh. Let me say, just I think picking up on what John was saying, Trumpism is not dead, and it's not going to die anytime soon. And I think the worst instincts of populism will continue to percolate through American society, and we don't know for how long. But I think while the world, not only Canada, but the world probably would like, with the election of Joe Biden, things to go back to normal, whatever that meant for us before January 2016. That's not going to be so easy to do. I think a lot of genies have been released in the US and elsewhere, and it's not going to be easy to put those back in the bottle, and it is going to call upon every skill that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and their team have to try and move America forward together, trying to unify these disparate parts, and the anger that Donald Trump, and even the hate, I would say, that Donald Trump gave license to. So I don't think we should be I don't think that we should be under any illusions in terms of what has happened in America, the fragility of democracy as an institution, and the fact that Joe Biden and his team are going to have a real tough job, I think, in terms of bringing a lot of these disparate pieces back together. I will say this. I think normalcy in one sense, or in many senses, will return not only to America, but to our relationship with America and the world's relationship with America. Joe Biden's tone is going to be a tone and an approach that we recognize in terms of dealing with the rest of the world and dealing with Canada. You're going to see a lot less use of executive orders, for example. Executive orders that come out of nowhere because a president got up in the morning and he heard something on Fox News. And I think that that's good for business. That's good for all of us, where in fact decision making becomes more considered, more thoughtful. Cabinet secretaries are responsible for their departments. They are thoughtful decision makers. A lot of the names that will be around Joe Biden are names that all of us have been used to, whether it was with George W. Bush, whether it was with Barack Obama. I think there will be a return to some sense of normalcy in how America deals with us and the rest of the world, and that is good for business. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Anne. So maybe we can drill down on the oil industry. Keystone has been mentioned. So 4 points I'd like to the panel to consider. One, Keystone, will American workers ally with Canada to hopefully get Joe Biden to change his mind? What's the hope there? Fracking, if there's a squeeze on fracking in the United States, does that help Canadian producers? I suspect it would hurt Canadian frackers that operate in the US. What's the impact there? Emissions controls, as you know, they were rolled back in the last administration. What does that do for oil and gas consumption in North America? And Iran, if sanctions are lifted, there's another million barrels a day coming into the world market. So this combination of events, what's that mean for the Canadian oil and gas industry? Who'd like to take that on first?
One thing that's very true is that Joe Biden will take a much more progressive view on climate change. I think he actually will, by presidential order, roll back all of the changes that President Trump has made and return to where it was simply the day before Trump took office. I think he will be supportive of the Paris Accord. He will be supportive of tougher measures on air quality, on GHG emissions. And I think that could be potentially a benefit for Canada in that we lose, you know, the gap in our competitiveness. That could be good for Canadian business. When it comes to fracking, I think he will stop all fracking on federal lands. And I think he will kill Keystone XL. It's such an easy thing for him to, an easy thing he could throw at the base. He was very clear, both as vice president and then during this campaign, that he was anti-Keystone. And depending on what happens with that Georgia election, if it is a Republican Senate, that'll almost be a gift to Biden, that he won't have to appeal to the extremists within the Democratic Party. You know, in Canada, we have the NDP and the Liberals, so the more progressives are with the NDP. In the United States, there's only one party, so that it's got both a centrist and a center-left wing. And Biden is fundamentally a moderate, in my opinion. It's just the people around him and the people with his party that he's got to kowtow to, which will be problematic for him and, frankly, probably for Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker.
Anne, you're muted.
Just say, sitting here in Alberta, I mean, obviously the provincial government has invested a lot in getting Keystone over the line. The government of Canada supports the building of Keystone, but I agree with John. I think pulling the presidential permit on Keystone is low-hanging fruit. If he wants to give an immediate, easy in quotes, signal to the left side of the Democratic Party, I do think that Keystone, and he's been consistent. Obama did not support a Keystone. Biden did not support Keystone. Nobody should be surprised as to where President Biden will come from on Keystone. They have been absolutely consistent that they oppose the building of that pipeline. I know that people are working hard. Our ambassador, James Rajat, who's Alberta's representative in Washington, reaching out, have been for months on Keystone with the possibility that Biden would become the president. My guess is they won't make much headway, and Keystone is gone. But in relation to fracking, I think Biden was misrepresented, I guess, by the president. He said fracking on federal lands. I think fracking will continue, but we've seen the market actually take a big chunk out of fracking in the United States. So it may not require Biden to do anything. And I think on the green economy, actually, there may be some parts of that that get through even a Republican-controlled Senate. Some of the small parts of that, where in fact it seems to make sense for everybody. But yeah, I mean, the worst or most extreme parts of a potential green agenda, I think, will be moderated by the fact that it will be a split government unless something remarkable happens in Georgia.
John, any views? Christy?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with the comments on Keystone. It seems to me that this is one that's pretty straightforward and that's been part of the Democratic, really, that's been their position since the Obama years. Hillary promised not to authorize it as well in the campaign in 2016. So I think that's one that is, it's going to be very hard for Biden to reverse. It's worth noting, though, that the presidential permit was issued by Donald Trump 3.5 years ago, and the pipeline's still not built for other reasons. So I think, you know, sometimes these things just can't get done. And I have to wonder whether the decision that, as it then was, TransCanada made way back to change the route wasn't a fateful one. That finally, when the books are written, we'll say that may have cost them the decision. And that leads me to a point about some of the other issues that you raised, Hugh, and that is to always remember that the United States, like Canada, is a federal system. And some of these issues are not decided in Washington. They're decided in state capitals. It was state intervention and then judicial intervention that delayed Keystone. Many of the states, fracking will be a locally decided issue on non-federal land. Likewise, with emission controls, we all know that those tend to be decided to some degree by the large states that can dictate to the industry. You asked about Iran. I'm not so sure that we'll get a reconstitution of the nuclear agreement with Iran. I think a lot of water has gone under the bridge since then. Iran has been, let's say they have been a force of disruption in the Middle East. They haven't won friends. Some of the other parties to the agreement continue to deal with them. The Chinese engagement with Iran makes it difficult for a Biden administration to begin to rewarm that relationship. So I'm not expecting a release of those sanctions by the United States anytime soon. Subset of that, and I suspect you'll get to this, might be, what about those who are accused of somehow or other violating those sanctions, does the name Meng Wanzhou come to mind?
Christy?
Thanks. I think, let me start with fracking, because I spent 6.5 years of my life attracting a LNG industry to Canada, which we finally did with the $40 billion Shell investment. And so I would love to see the Americans become less competitive and do less fracking. I don't think, though, that they are going to put fracking. Hold on a second. I don't know what's going on with this. I don't think, though, that they're going to end up with
there are two things here in the United States that are going to be happening in the background. One is mostly there's going to be the huge fight that's going to go on within the Democratic Party around what do they do next? They ran a terrible campaign. They practically lost the election. They lost seats in the House. They didn't win the Senate as expected, and they barely are going to win the president of the White House. So I think there's going to be a lot of soul searching internally about what they want to do, and I think that politics is really going to be at the fore. Pennsylvania and those states where fracking is popular amongst union voters is going to be going to play a big role in that decision for them. And we shouldn't underestimate the power of the unions in the Democratic Party either. If you go back and look at Joe Biden's platform, almost every item in it makes a reference to the importance of unions and strengthening unions in the United States. And they are, by and large, very much in favor of oil and gas. So I think the Americans are probably, I think the Biden administration will make small moves on fracking. The amount of fracking that happens on federal land is quite small as a percentage of their production. But I do think they're going to do a lot to kill it, perhaps some of it without intention, through regulation, through over-regulation, over-taxation, higher royalties, all the rest of that. I think on Keystone, I think it's a gimme that they are going to kill Keystone as part of, or try to, part of the bread and butter of environmentalists in the Democratic Party, and he's going to have to keep some of those folks happy. I do wonder, though, whether or not, and I may be disagreeing with Anne a little bit here, he will withhold himself back from using executive orders. I don't think the Democrats have shown themselves to be the most principled people when it comes to do as I say and do as I do. You could see that with the way that they treated Republican Supreme Court nominees in the past. So I'm not sure that Joe Biden's going to hold to that promise that he's not going to use executive orders. So you may see a lot of that around oil and gas. And I do agree with John Baird that they'll move quickly on emissions because I think that's, again, a fairly easy thing to do and probably on top of mind for most Americans. And I think on the Iran deal, it's going to be hard to put that back together. I just don't think with a president that's distracted by politics all of the time, has Donald Trump out there heckling away from the side seats, I think it's going to be tough for him to put something like that together, and I don't think it's particularly politically popular anyway.
Great, thank you. Well, it sounds like tough innings for Keystone. I hope that those 8,000 employees recently hired in the U.S. would have some input, some greater political input, but it sounds like it might be an uphill battle. Why don't we move on? Stimulus. And I guess some of this is going to depend on what happens with the Senate races in Georgia. Presuming the Democrats don't take the Senate, are we going to see a more muted stimulus or just a different stimulus? And part two is, if it's not as large as anticipated by the markets, what does that mean for the Fed and interest rates?
Well, both incumbents in Georgia are Republican, and they will sit in the Senate in the interim period. I think there will be a stimulus, but it'll be demonstrably more modest than the Speaker Pelosi wants.
Well, one of the interesting political factors in this, Hugh, is that if as we're saying, Biden wins the presidency and the Senate remains controlled by the Republicans, the happiest man in Washington is Mitch McConnell. He now becomes the most powerful Republican in Washington. That's an important thing to remember. And you know, like it or not, Donald Trump is very unlikely to be the nominee 4 years hence. And in fact, you know, I take Christie's point about the Democrats, the Republican Party is fractured as well. Some of the most important and potent advertising in the campaign was done by unhappy Republicans that formed the Lincoln Project that took on the president tooth and nail. My former counterpart, Tom Ridge, was on CNN this morning. Tom Ridge has been opposed to Donald Trump from well before he won the nomination. There are a lot of Republicans in that category. The McCain Republicans, you can call them, or the George W. Bush Republicans. That's a fractured party as well. Where does Mitch McConnell hope to take that party over the next number of years? While the Democrats have to figure out a way to appeal to middle America, the Republicans have to figure out a way to appeal to much of urban America and a much more modern, a much more multicultural America. So I think the politics of this positioning of the parties is going to be fascinating. I think it leads to perhaps Nancy Pelosi will not get everything she wants, but I think that you will see a stimulus package. It will be a generous one, and that it will once again buoy the markets. You know, as a former finance minister, this drives me mad because I can't get my head around, you know, who and when and how this is all going to get sorted out with deficits in the U.S. and the multi-trillions of dollars in Canada now approaching $400 billion. I don't know. It just seems like a big transfer to the older generations on the backs of the younger, but perhaps others will figure that out.
Hugh, there's been some discussion that the Republicans in the period between now and the swearing in of Joe Biden, that actually in that 6 week period, there might be some take up for what they're calling a skinny stimulus, maybe $500 billion, what, you know, numbers are thrown around, certainly not the trillion and a half that Nancy Pelosi's looking for in a big deal. But I don't know whether that's possible. Certainly, I think there is some pressure for something to be done in the pretty short term, because if you look at what's happening in America in relation to COVID, the numbers are going up, the death rate is going up, hospitals are again starting to get overwhelmed, businesses will probably have to shut down. There is going to have to be some stimulus, and one might think in a relatively short term. Now, whether Republicans in the Senate have any appetite, or the president himself, maybe if he wanted to go out on a high note, some kind of skinny stimulus to help the American people and small and medium-sized business in this interim period would be well received, and the markets would receive that well. Whether Nancy Pelosi is able to get a $1.5 trillion stimulus after Joe Biden is sworn in, I think if it's a Republican-controlled Senate, that's not going to happen.
So I'm assuming if it's a skinny stimulus, there's real pressure on the Fed. But why don't we transition to taxes? Joe Biden has said taxes are going up. Is that net good or bad for Canada? I mean, on the one hand, it takes away the competitive advantage they've had in recent years. On the other hand, it might just give Ottawa cover to raise taxes here. And then again, it might also just slow down the U.S. economy that's our biggest customer. So how does that play out for Canadians and Canadian businesses?
I would say, Hugh, that first of all, I don't think Justin Trudeau's government has needs any cover to raise taxes. They haven't seemed to require that so far in Canada. But second, I would say that when Trump cut regulation in the United States and he cut taxes in the United States, we saw Canada at a very distinct new disadvantage, which was terrible for us. And, you know, I know from a business perspective, regulations are actually even more of a concern, the regulatory tangle in Canada than the tax burden, but both really matter. And sadly, the answer we want is for Canada to be lower taxed and lower regulated, or more smartly regulated. In the absence of that, if we want to close the competitive gap, it might be the Biden way, which is higher taxes and higher regulation on America.
Comes down to the Senate. If Joe Biden can honor his campaign commitments to raise taxes, particularly on the rich, yeah, he'll do it. There's unlimited support for eating the rich when it comes to taxation policy, and he would have an easy constituency if he has control. That would obviously be good for Canada because it would eliminate the differential and make us a little more competitive. But I think the reality is, you know, if I'm advising people on tax matters, which I don't normally, I would say that the likelihood of a corporate tax increase or a capital gains capital increase or you know, the top marginal rate going even higher under the Liberal government in Ottawa is really real and significant. Christie is completely right. Justin Trudeau doesn't need any cover to raise taxes. This is not the same macroeconomic policy of Anne McClellan and John Manley.
Well, I never had to deal with a global pandemic or a massive recession. So while I take pride in running a surplus as Minister of Finance, I have a lot of sympathy for what's being faced in Ottawa today. When I look at what we've got right now, and quite frankly, I'm not a critic of what the government has done with respect to trying to support Canadians and businesses during the pandemic. I think that the cost of not doing that would have been horrific. And so it's been important that they do that. I am concerned about, as I said earlier, about how we end up paying for this. And I was very concerned, I have to say, at the tone of the recent speech from the throne, which implied that despite the massive obligations undertaken by the government in the face of COVID, that notwithstanding that, they still had big plans for large new programs of spending. I mean, as I see it, COVID has put some of those big programs, future programs, maybe we'll get to them one day, out of reach for the time being. And how you would come up with the money, and there are various estimates of what those programs, the new programs would cost, somewhere in the $30-40 billion range a year. Where would you get the money for that? Well, you're going to raise taxes for it. John's listed some. Every year, and this has been true, this isn't a Trudeau government phenomenon. This goes back as long as I've been following it. The Department of Finance puts out its annual list of tax expenditures. Those are the exemptions or deductions or special treatments that are in the Tax Act. Populist politicians call them loopholes. They're not loopholes at all. Loopholes are unintended. These are perfectly legal and they are intended, but they are expensive. And high on that list is the exemption for paying capital gains on the gain on a principal residence. High on the list is the 50% rate of inclusion for other capital gains. And then there's a host of other things. The only thing the government so far has said they'll raise taxes on is stock options. You know, now we're talking in the millions, not in the billions, which is what's required. Whether it's good policy or not, another thing. But I agree with John. I think there is there's very little likelihood that over the next 3 to 5 years, we won't see tax increases everywhere you can turn, because governments are going to have to start dealing with this massive amount of debt that's been built up during COVID. Sorry for the bad news, folks, but that's just the reality.
Can I shift to cannabis and maybe, Anne, direct this one to you? Cannabis? Several states just approved legalized cannabis, I take it.
Yep.
I presume that's good news for Canadian cannabis companies. Is there more to come? Is there a possibility of the feds rolling over in the U.S.?
I think, Hugh, to your point, 15 states now have legalized cannabis for recreational use, five new ones coming out of the election on Tuesday, New Jersey being a big one. And medicinal now is virtually countrywide. Even the state of Mississippi, I think, on Tuesday voted to go medicinal. There should be opportunities for Canada. Canada has the edge here as only the second country and the only OECD country to legalize cannabis nationally. There is a lot of intelligence, experience, the genetics of the plant. I've never heard so many people talk about the love of a plant as when I was chairing the task force on the legalization of cannabis. So many people in love with the plant, the genetics of the plant, the research going into the plant, the potential, both recreational use, but medicinal use of cannabis. A lot more research has to be done. Canada, I am afraid, though, that we are not seizing that first mover advantage that we should have. And I think there are ways that we can still retrieve that situation, but there will be opportunities for Canada. And does the federal government in the U.S. tip? No, not right away. This is not high on Joe Biden's list of to-dos, but I do think there's no question with more states legalizing, Republican and Democrat, the pressure will grow regardless of who's the president and who controls the Senate to actually make the move to to legalize for recreational purposes. Canada, as I say, should have first mover advantage. I do think there are opportunities there. And there are going to be a lot of joint ventures between Canadian and U.S. companies, a lot of research in the pharma sector, and so on.
Anyone else on cannabis? I think that's the definitive word would come from Anne and having run that.
One of my favorite topics, Hugh, as you know.
But Hugh, one of the things to remember is because some of these states have legalized, and the Canadian industry cannot export to those states. It may be legal in the state of Washington, but a BC producer can't export to the state of Washington. That's a big market. So that producers in the state of Washington, to use that as an example, are gaining scale and Canadians are not able to cross that border. So this has been a problem. It's why so many of the Canadians are looking at ways of investing in the U.S. Because in the states where it's legal, because they can't move product across that border until the federal government makes that legal to do so.
That's absolutely right.
Okay, so maybe we shift down to border issues. A couple of points. Does this change at all when the border opens between Canada and the United States for regular traffic? Point one. Point two, I think we've seen in the last 4 years, and maybe in the last 12 years, how effective the administrative connections between Canadian and U.S. officials have been in keeping the border moving, keep making it happen. We haven't seen a lot of support from the administration, I don't think of Obama or Trump, pushing that agenda. Do you think Joe Biden, as a northern person, is more likely to drive the agenda so we have more innovation and openness on the border?
The key is, and Anne and I both have this responsibility with Tom Ridge as our counterpart, for both of us, in fact. The key here is who is the Secretary of Homeland Security, and we saw a change in the time. I think Anne can speak to this, but when she was responsible, the change from Tom Ridge to his successor was a complete change in orientation about how the border was to work. We went from Ridge, who was governor of Pennsylvania, very very commercially oriented, trade oriented, to a new secretary who saw the border as one of the places where you enforce law and order. And it's a totally different mindset. And we've had a variety of those people over the years. So I think, as the cabinet gets unveiled, that is a key position. And hopefully the person on the Canadian side does what Ann and I did, which is to decide whether he likes it or not. He's going to be our best friend.
No, that's exactly right. John hasn't, he's mentioned Tom Ridge. Tom Ridge was someone who said, what's the problem and how do we get out of the way all the unnecessary rules and regulations to make sure that we achieve our objective, which was the free flow of goods and people. Michael Chertoff, actually Ridge's successor, took a national security perspective to the border. And that changes everybody's thinking. It's about stopping terrorism at the borders and so on. And all of a sudden, you're back into a much more bureaucratic, functionary-driven approach. That slowed things down at the border. Hugh, you should mention that your Wilson Center Canada project, which you chair, right? Hugh is going to start a new project looking at the border, coming out of COVID, but looking at the border between the two countries and whether or not there are things that we should be recommending to both governments to make sure that we're facilitating the free flow of goods and people.
Which is essential.
Yeah. Clearly.
With respect to the border, there are some opportunities here. You couldn't find two politicians who are more different than Donald Trump and Justin Trudeau. They were basically, I think the government was very competent in dealing with Trump for the first 18 months, and then it went south. But I think the personal relationship between Trudeau and Biden will be tremendously important. And hopefully that can assist, whether it's, you know, if I was Justin Trudeau, I might very well ask President Biden to withdraw the extradition request for Madam Meng, so that the China issue can be successfully addressed. You know, he also might say, listen, can you throw me a bone on softwood lumber? I mean, it was Stephen Harper working directly with George W. Bush to get the softwood lumber issue dealt with. Obama was not a friend of Canada on that issue, and certainly Trump hasn't been. So anything is now possible, and the personal relationship will be much, much more important. And there's no doubt that Trudeau will get along much better with Biden on a personal level. Plus, you know, Biden will get along well with people on Capitol Hill. He's a nice guy. He's well regarded. He's you know, part of the club at the U.S. Senate. And I don't think you'll see the open hostility that you had between, you know, Pelosi and Schumer to President Trump. I think they'll be able to do business.
And I don't think we should forget about the relationships between the states and the federal government in the U.S. I mean, these democratic states along the border, I mean, in my case, we think about Washington State, where there's been a fairly free flow of traffic, particularly the Nexus Pass and all those things that were piloted at the beginning in British Columbia with Mr. Harper and Mr. Campbell's government. And, you know, free flow of traffic and some fairly consistent policymaking from British Columbia down through Washington State, Oregon, down to California. Those are Democratic states that now are back reconnected to their federal government. And so where you see Democrat states around the border, I think you're going to see a better responsiveness amongst the federal government in Washington, D.C., as well as John said, that strengthened relationship between President Biden and Prime Minister Trudeau.
Great. I'd like to remind our viewers, if they have questions, to send them in on the Q&A chat line. Moving over to other matters, at the risk of endorsing cultural appropriation, are we going to see the three leaders of North America, three principal leaders, wearing sombreros anytime soon?
You can't say that anymore.
Are we going to see the three amigos ride together?
Better with Obrador than Trump did, that's for sure.
Trump is just toxic
in Mexico.
Yeah, I think the COVID problem is a major barrier to getting that sorted out, because quite frankly, I think it's been very difficult for Mexico to afford the kinds of measures that Canada and the U.S. have taken. And consequently, AMLO has kind of taken a position of, you know, bury his head in the sand on COVID. And I think that makes it difficult. On trade, I'm hopeful that we will see very strong implementation of the new USMCA or CUSMA, if you want to use put Canada first. that's going to, I think, require a certain amount of encouragement, especially to see that Mexico complies with some of the rules that that they agreed to in that negotiation. But I think it's key. I don't subscribe to the view that the USMCA was somehow a depreciated version of the old NAFTA. I think it actually contains a lot of upgrades as a trade agreement, including much of, ironically, of, that was just taken out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and put into the new NAFTA, all of which is modernizing and good. Some things we probably wouldn't have liked to see, but overall, it's a good modern agreement, and I think it's very important for Canada. And I think that one of the things we've learned since 1994, when the first NAFTA came into effect, is that Mexico is a big market. You know, Mexico's middle class is the size of the total Canadian population, and Canadian firms and businesses have a lot to benefit from by engaging with Mexico. And we have a lot of knowledge to share with them in how to do things. And a lot of Canadian investment has flowed there, both in the financial sector and the oil and gas sector and others. And I'm hopeful, Hugh. I don't know whether it'll be the three amigos as it was with you know, back with Kretchen, I think I coined that expression with Clinton and, I don't know, President Zedillo perhaps. But I think that there's a big agenda there that could be pursued. And what President Biden brings is the lack of hostility to Mexico that was demonstrated so often by President Trump and his supporters. And that's an opening to try to patch up that relationship, which after all, sorry, I'm going on a bit long here, but the first NAFTA was not intended by George H.W. Bush so much as a trade agreement as a geopolitical agreement to turn Mexicanized North into the North American community and away from countries like Cuba and Venezuela and other troublemakers in Latin America, and to build the Mexican economy so that the immigration flows into the U.S. were normalized. And on both of those counts, the first NAFTA was a massive success. Unfortunately, a lot of Americans have forgotten that was the real purpose, and hopefully with the revised NAFTA, we get back to that North American vision.
Thanks, John.
Hugh, I don't think the Americans are gonna monkey much with NAFTA. I don't think they're gonna pay very much attention to, under a Biden administration, to trade within North America. I think that USMCA, it's working, it's in place. I think they're going to try and avoid the politics of all that. The politics of trade within the left wing of the Democratic, the so-called progressives in the Democratic Party are anti-trade. The politics of the unions are anti-free trade. And the politics of the Trump people are anti-free trade. So you really kind of have this small rump of moderates in the Republicans. Well, and not all of them moderate in the Republicans, but there's a smaller number of those people. And then the small number of moderates that are left in the Democratic Party who would actually care about it. So I just don't think that they're going to try and get into that. I do think that they're going to talk about trade with China. I think they'll be tough on China, maybe not as tough as Trump was, but I think that they're going to go after that as a strong political leg of their stool, and then pursue freer trade with Europe and some of our traditional partners. I think that's where you'll start to see some action on the trade front. I think you'll see a lot of moderation on it just because it'll become more rational. But if the best we're hoping for is that they don't monkey with what we've got now, that's not the worst thing in the world, because a Trump presidency would probably mean a lot more change that wouldn't be in the right direction for Canada.
Hugh, one thing I would say is people do need to remember that Joe Biden, and Christie has just, I think, made this point. What did he talk about? Whether it was in relation to the green economy or the big infrastructure deal, which he would like to do, and actually the Republicans may buy into in the Senate, it was about Buy American. America first. And that rhetoric is not that different than that which we were hearing from the president. But then you've got this other orientation in Joe Biden, which is as a multilateralist, right? As someone who believes in multilateral relationships, whether it is the North American multilateral relationship, which we would all argue is unique, or other multilateral relationships. I don't think Joe Biden is going to rush out and sign on to the TPP anytime soon. Don't misrepresent what I'm thinking. But I do think these are they're conflicting sentiments within the man himself. But at the end of the day, he made some pretty strong statements and commitments about Buy American, America first, and he will have to deliver jobs in America. He talked about he is going to have to deliver on those agendas, and I think that's not going to necessarily be all that easy for either Canada or Mexico. Although if we actually got our act together and were this North American juggernaut, there could be mutual benefit for everybody.
So if we were to think of manufacturing in Central Canada, a couple of points. Buy America can't be very good, I presume, so that's not getting any better. Immigration, are we going to have to compete for the Asian H-1B tech workers with Silicon Valley again, or do we still have a bit of a lock? John, you're muted.
I'll jump in.
The anti-immigration sentiment of the Trump administration will dissipate, and we're going to have to fight harder and harder to get the best and the brightest for the high-tech sector, especially. And I just to echo what Ann said on Buy America. I mean, President Obama might have been very popular in Canada, but he put Buy America in every one of his budget bills. The administration was pushing it, and I think Biden will do the same. The Democrats are hardcore, protectionists. And unfortunately for us, is the biggest Republican who's a protectionist is leaving office. So that can only be positive.
John?
Yeah, I think that's basically right. I think, though, that, the Americans have been mercantilists forever. And Donald Trump wasn't the inventor, as John was saying, of the Buy America policy. And we've been very good at working through that, often province to state. Sometimes the use of the supply chain mechanism to make sure that we continue to produce and the U.S. continues to buy, but we're just a component of their production. So that, typically, Buy America is not intended to be targeted at Canada. It's usually targeted at China. And we just need to be very attentive and clever and careful. And every once in a while, Christy would know this, the premier of a province has to get tough and say to a bordering governor, if you do that, well, then your people are going to have trouble doing business in my province. And in some of those cases, the balance of trade actually favors the Americans. So it's not just us trying to get into their market. They want to be in our market, and that's that works our way. I agree with John on the immigration issue, though. I think it's one of the things to watch, actually, is that competition for talent and the impact that higher taxation rates, especially at the higher end of the income scale, can have on attracting talent, because it's not so much that our top tax rates are way out of line with U.S. tax rates, sort of depends on what state and sometimes what city you look at, but you get to the top rate in Canada, $220,000 Canadian dollars, which is roughly half of what it takes in the U.S. to get to the top rate. And when you're trying to attract those bright, young, talented people into the technology sector, and they're typically making $200,000 a year, that tax rate is pretty steep for them. So just something for Canadian policymakers to keep in.
It's even worse than that. The top marginal rate kicks in Canada at 165 US, where in Texas and Florida kicks in at 565, and that's only 36%. So this is a huge challenge when you're looking at that talented doctor, that talented high-tech engineer at retaining them. And that's a big problem in this country.
You know, I do think the Biden administration will be better at on the immigration stuff. I am not sure, though, that the people that are intended to receive that message, which are potential immigrants from countries where, you know, where they may be worried about the results of this election and the feeling of Americans that's been expressed, and may still feel more comfortable in coming to Canada. So I think I agree with both Johns that it's, you know, it's really up to Canada to figure out how we're going to exploit what I think is still an immigration opportunity. And, you know, our federal government has made things a little bit easier, this current federal government, which has surprised me, but it's great. We still have a long, long way to go. I mean, provinces should be running immigration, not the federal government. And tech companies should be getting, if they're, you know, they should be able to get some kind of a certification so that they can manage most of the process on looking at immigrants that are going to be applying to work for them. We still have an advantage on the Canadian dollar for employers. We still have an advantage in that healthcare doesn't cost employers anything when they come here. They pay Canadians less than they do Americans at most of those tech companies. So we still have some advantages if we can find our way to get there. I mean, there are things like, for example, Canada should say, if you earn a PhD in Canada and you don't have a criminal record where you come from, you automatically become a Canadian citizen. Those kinds of things would attract the best and brightest from around the world, but we're not really applying that kind of imagination to the problem ahead of us. And this is, you know, talent is the number one challenge that Canada faces.
To Christy's point, as I think everybody knows, the government last week made a move in that direction, Christy, to facilitate ease of citizenship for a wide range of people who are currently here, either as students or employees on short-term visas and so on. But Christy said something else that I think is really important. The fact that Joe Biden is president is not going to change all those ugly pictures that people in other parts of the world have of violence against those of different colors and ethnicities, the general tone and rhetoric that you see in too much of social media in America. I actually think while Joe Biden will obviously come from a very different place personally, that we on image to the rest of the world, I do believe Canada still has a substantial advantage in terms of providing a comfortable, inclusive environment in spite of the taxation issue, but a place. What do I hear a lot is where people from other parts of the world want to raise their kids and where they think those kids will be safe. Right? Which is something we as Canadians don't always think about because we take safety pretty much as a given, day in, day out, for ourselves and our kids. That's really important to a lot of people around the world when they think about where they want to live and pursue not only a career, but a family life. So to Christy's point, I think we still have advantage and we need to pursue it vigilantly.
Right now, I would assume the PMO is considering its initial moves. I take it it's likely that it's hopeful that Biden's first trip will be here. Given his popularity in Canada, it would probably be well received and we could give him a royal reception with lots of red surge. Is there an opportunity for Canada at that moment maybe to get some early favors while there's still a bit of a glow and Biden's reaching out to the world again? Is that an opportunity for Canada?
Absolutely. You got to try. You know, anything now is is possible other than Keystone. So I'm sure the PMO has a long list. They've been they were very smart, the PM and his cabinet. They stayed out of the election. They shut up. Canada being an election issue in the United States, there's no way we can win. So we were fortunate that they kept quiet, but now they've got it's just a new world.
And don't forget, Justin Trudeau is still very, very popular in the United States with a lot of folks. I mean, he's kind of his star power is, popular, kind of at a mass level. He's still pretty strong around the world. So be a good guy for Biden to be seen with.
And keep in mind, Hugh, as I said earlier, a lot of the people around Biden, his secretaries, his staff, are going to be people well known to official Canada, whether it's Ottawa or a lot of the provinces. And that, the government of which John was a part, the governments of which John and I were a part, that goes back way too far. But some of those people are going to be around Biden. Some of the people around Obama, who had strong relationships with Canadian officials, elected and unelected, you're going to see those relationships reemerge. And I think that will provide a strategic opportunity for Canada to reset this relationship.
All right, we're hitting up against time. Unfortunately, we didn't get to all of the questions, but I think we got to most of the themes. I should say our next public policy event is going to be in December when we release the semi-annual economic report that's prepared and long anticipated in the financial community, written by David Dodge, Serge Dupont, Michael Horgan, Valerie Hughes, and others. It covers off the economy, trade, and many issues. Look for that on our website on December 9th. Panelists, thank you very much. A very polite group. No one had to be muted. Viewers, thanks very much for joining us, and let's hope Canada comes through this as well as it possibly could. Have a wonderful day.